session number 1448, reel 1.
Mr. Tanner, reel 1, how do, and when did you come to be in the parachutes, please?
Well, my main reason for joining the parachute regiment, although this may sound stupid to some people, I was stationed at Catterick Camp with the Royal Tank Regiment. And it was one of the most awful places that I've ever been to. And then the chance came when this officer came round. We didn't know it was parachuting at the time. All we saw was like these sort of little tiny, what we thought were pilot wings on his shoulder. And he began to explain, you know, the job, blowing up telephone wires and bridges and attacking this and that sort of stuff. Well then, as I say, he explained what would be entailed, and we'd have to go through certain training, etc. and so forth. So, to a man, there was five of us in the tank crew, so to a man, we all volunteered. We had a rough medical, and then we had to wait quite a while before eventually we was told to report to Clay Cross, which is up in Chesterfield, to a place called Harbick Hall. And there we went through a series of rigorous training. It was very, very rigorous indeed. The first thing you had to do when you came out of any room or any building, you had to run everywhere. You wasn't allowed to walk, you had to double. The training, well, it was like everyday training, but just that little bit extra to what the normal troops went through, which a part of the assault course was going through a pond, or lake as it's known really now, and even in winter time you still went through that lake, no excuses. And then after all this, you had this 10-mile road run and walk, which you had to do in a certain time. If you didn't, you were either retired or you had the option of going back to your old unit. When that was completed, you were then sent to Ringway. Now there, it was the opposite. The RAF treated you like angels, if you like. There was no pressure put on you, anything like that. And I suppose that was because they realised, you know, the job you had in hand. The peril of jumping, the thought of flying. Some people hated flying. It didn't make no difference to me. I'd already flown before I joined the army, you know, in these different air pageants, you see. And we had to do those jumps, two from a balloon. You had one night balloon jump, and then the rest was done from the aircraft. Now, the aircraft at this particular time were Whitley bombers. You had to jump through a hole. Now, after you'd done your seventh jump, you then was confronted with an officer who gave you the option of either finishing there and then and being returned to your own unit. No charges, nothing would be said against you. But once you completed that eighth jump, you was then a qualified paratrooper. And if you refused to jump after that, 84 days detention. No mucking about. 84 days detention. Well, we finally completed our jumps. But during the course of these jumps, we had decided at one time that I think it was the third one, we decided that was enough. We wasn't going to do no more. So whoever was going to be the first out of us lot to jump out of these aircraft, he was going to refuse, we was going to back him up. But like a fool he went, so we all followed him.
Why had you decided not to jump?
Well, we thought that was it. A lot of us had changed our mind in a way. But, you know, the thought of, you know, what was in the future, if you know what I mean. But anyhow, it happened and we became fully qualified paratroopers. And from there we were sent down to a holding unit for a while in Bulford. And from there, I then joined the 7th Light Infantry Parachute Battalion.
What happened to you at Bulford?
Well, that's when the business really started. Exercises, jumping exercises. I think it was Exmoor, I'm not too sure, Dartmoor. Then there was different places around the country where there was a dropping zone available. You went through exercise after exercise, jumping, you know, then like you had certain other units, they would be the enemy sort of style, if you know what I mean. And then our job was to infiltrate where they were. Their job was to try and capture us. It was all part and parcel of the thing that was going to come.
Practicing tactics.
It's all practice. But there was no messing about. You couldn't afford to mess about, because you realised that when you dropped, you was going to be an isolated unit until the main forces got through. You must remember, a parachutist, whether he's a top brass man, a colonel, whether you're a private, he's got no front, he's got no flank, he's got no rear. He's on his own until the main forces come through. And until that, he's got to fight with every means that he can. And he really has to use his common sense. There's no room for sentimentality or anything like that. Inasmuch if you see a friend, you know, your friend beside you drops because he's been killed or he's been wounded, you can't afford to muck about. You've got Royal Army Medical Corps people. That was their job, to look after him. Forget him. Think of yourself. It was one word, really, survival. Survival and nothing more. That's all you could think about, you see. Now, what you must remember is that you only carried so much food with you, and you only carried so much ammunition with you. And once you ran out of that, it was just a question of make do. If you found any of the enemy's weapons, will he use those instead?
Who was in charge of your unit?
Well, our commanding officer.
Yes?
Oh, his name was Lieutenant Colonel Pinecoffin. Geoffrey Pinecoffin. And he was, and I'm not saying this because I'm being taped, he was the finest officer that any man could wish for. But I must also say at the same time that every officer that we had with us in the parachute regiment were virtually hand-picked. They didn't have any Tom, Dick or Harry.
Why did you think so much about Pinecoffin?
Well, he was for the men. He wasn't one of those, well, because I'm an officer, I'm above you. He never gave you the impression he was above you. He knew what you had to do. Bearing in mind that the private had to rely on the corporal. The corporal had to rely on the sergeant. The sergeant had to rely on the officer. And so forth, all the way up. And it was a reverse situation, wasn't it, really? Because the CO had to rely on his officers. His officers had to rely on us. I mean, they lead you. They lead you into battle. But you've got to remember, it's the private soldier that fights that battle and wins that battle. You see? But he never degraded you. Any officer that he thought was going to be... he wasn't going to come up to scratch, he got rid of him. He didn't want him. You had to do more or less what he said, if you know what I mean. You had to treat them as men, not as dogs, pigs or anything. They were men and they were fighting with you. And it was as simple as that.
You were in the 7th Parachute Battalion.
That's correct.
Which company and platoon were you?
B Company, 6th Platoon, 9th Section.
Can you tell me about what role your particular battalion and company was supposed to carry out on D-Day?
Well, the D-Day, the first thing we had to do was to come together. And then the main object, first of all, was the bridge, Pegasus Bridge. Well, then I believe it was C Company had the job of that. A Company was at Boonerville. Yeah, that's correct, if I remember. And B Company was a little place called Leeport. Each position was a vital position because it covered that route coming up from, I think it was Wistra, or where the boys landed it, on the beaches. Now, our biggest problem at Leeport was snipers. And they were very good men. People must realise that the German soldier was one of the finest fighting units. I even go as much as to say he was better than us, bearing in mind that his discipline was stronger than us. You see, but as fast as one sniper was killed, so another seemed to take his place. Well, then you had a Corporal Colleen, Tommy Colleen. He was in charge of the Piats. That's a former mortar. Anyway, he got into a position and he fired a Piat into this tower, a church tower actually, and he got a direct hit.
This was in La Porte itself, was
it? In La Porte itself. And if I remember rightly, I think it was about 10, between 10 and 12 German snipers were killed there and then. And the most remarkable thing about Tommy Colleen, which we laugh at now when we think of it, was when he entered the church, he took his hat off. You know, when you're under battle conditions, them sort of things don't come into your mind. I mean, today, if you walk into a church, what do? You take your hat off, don't you? But in those days, I mean, I would have thought he wouldn't have bothered, but he did. He actually took his helmet off before he entered.
Can you tell me about the build-up to D-Day and how you actually went across from your own experience?
Well, it was a build-up thing. Every unit was more or less the same. The build-up was training, exercises, more training, firing on the, you know, down to the firing ranges, learning how to, you know, to fire properly. You had to learn everything, the Bren gun, the rifle, the Sten gun. You had to fire a Piat. You had to learn to fire a mortar. Even though it wasn't your job, the idea was that if a mortar man got killed or a Piat operator got killed, you could take it over. You knew what to do. As simple as that, you see. Well, then, from there, it was nothing else but map reading, route marches. But another thing they would do, nothing to be woke up in the middle of the night. Get yourself dressed, get yourself ready. Don't want no equipment, just get yourself ready. On the trucks, and they'd take you so far out, give you a map, give you a compass, that's your position, find your way home. Now, when you got back, they also asked you where you went. There were certain marks certain things that they left that you had to note. So they made sure you'd done it right. You didn't grab a backsheet lift or anything like that, you see. And this was all part and parcel of the training. Didn't matter what conditions were, whether it was rainy, it could be snow, it could be anything. You was going to do it. Simple as that. Avosat rations, if it was a long thing going to come off, say for 24 hours, then naturally you took Avosat rations out. And you sort of augmented your Avosat rations. I mean, I can remember going through fields of turnips, cabbages and stuff. And you collared a, you know, I know it's wrong to do it, but you nicked a turnip, you nicked a carrot. We've got spuds, cold spuds, raw spuds. Anything, you know, it was a simple thing to do. You had to learn to do this thing because when you was in action, it was going to be the self-same thing, wasn't it? If you had no food, you were going to nick anything that was available. I mean, crab apples are the worst things you can have for stomach ache, but by Christ, when you're in action and you're hungry, you're glad to eat them.
Where did your unit assemble for D-Day?
I don't actually know the name of the place. It wasn't far from Fairford Airfield. That was the airfield we took over from. I took off from Airfield in Stirling Bombers, actually.
What was the flight across like?
It wasn't too bad at all. It seemed a hell of a long time, to be quite honest, even taking off. You know, when the engines revved up and the aircraft started moving, and it seemed as though it was never, ever going to take off. You know, it's an uncanny feeling. You think, Christ, you know, I've come all this way and it's not going to happen. And then eventually you can feel that lift off. You know you're off then, you see. And then you're going over, you can't see the chaps because it was dark. It was obvious. But then, all right, one or two tried to sleep, one or two tried to sing, but that fell far away. And everybody just sort of sat back in their own thoughts, your own, you know, what you was thinking of.
What were you thinking of?
Well, first of all, back home, I wasn't married then, but mum and dad, the family, my girlfriend, and then I thought, Christ, you know, what's going to happen when I come out? Will I be it? Will I lose a leg? Will I lose an arm? Will I be blinded? All those things go through your mind. It's not the question of being dramatic or anything. If everybody tells the truth, that's what they thought of. And fear. All the fear was there. Everybody has to be frightened. No, there's no one will ever turn around to me and say when they went into action, they wasn't scared. I can't tell you on the tape what I would say, but I'll leave that to you. But it was the same with any action before you started. You had that fear. But that fear, in all honesty, I think prepared you for action, if you know what I mean. You knew that you was going to do something, and I think it made you more alert. You know, you couldn't afford to sort of relax, if you know what I mean. And, you know, nobody spoke. You just sat there and, it seemed a hell of a long journey. Really did. And then eventually, the dispatcher spoke up, you know, hook up, get, you know, ready for action. So you hooked up your lines and everything, got yourself ready, kit bags and whatever you was carrying. And then it was a question of checking off by numbers, making sure everybody, how that works out. You had number 20 at the back, was checked off by the co-pilot or one of the aircraft crews to make sure he was hooked up, his pin was in right, you know, that the clip didn't come undone. And then it was he would shout out, 20 okay, well, 20's already checked, 19 and so forth, and all the way down, it'd be 20 okay, 19 okay, 18, right the way down, you see. Now, when the dispatcher was satisfied, he's prepared, he gets himself ready, and then the doors opened. Now, the doors on the Stirling were in the floor. And believe it or not, when they opened, we could see, well, when it was just prior to jumping, you could see below, you know, the countryside and so forth. But when you look through the doors of those Stirlings, whoever devised them must have had a very good sense of humour. Because they was just like the outline of a coffin. It's incredible. It just gave you the outline of a coffin. And then, because down you went, you know, as soon as the red comes on. Now, we always worked on the position that once the red's on, don't bother for the dispatcher to shout go. You was told you got a 10-second red or whatever it was. Once that red went on, it was 1, 2, 3, count to 10, and out went number 1, 2, and you got out as quick as you could, because the quicker you got out, the closer you was when you landed. And that was your main idea, to get as close and get as many people together. But unfortunately, there was a little bit of a gust. One or two was when I say blown astray, it wasn't all that far, but far enough to be worried. You know, where's so and so? Where's Charlie Boy, John, Dick, Harry, and that, you see? And then it was a question of getting out of that chute as quickly as possible, getting your rifle, make sure everything was okay, and then locating the rest of your chaps, and then forming up, praying like hell that you got an NCO there or an officer. Because you knew that they knew more information. It only gave you the rough idea of what you've got to do. Although we had models, you know, these paper mash models or whatever it's called, and we were told, you know, that's Ranfield Church, that's Leport, that's Boonerville, that'll be the Pegasus Bridge, and gliders are going in here, blah, 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 and all the rest of it. But none the more for that, you was always pleased to know that there was someone that could lead you.
Who were you looking for?
Mr. Thomas, Lieutenant Thomas, and the rest of the ladies. Like, there was Chalky White, Bob Petrie, Bob Allen, Blondie Plant, Geordie Dodds, even
Mr. Crofts.
Phil Crofts. Although they were in different platoons, but you knew these ladies, they were B Company. That's all he was concerned about. But even so, it didn't make no difference if you didn't meet any 7th Battalion Black, as long as you met someone from the parachute regiment. Whether it was the 8th, the 9th, the 12th, 13th, or the 1st Canadians. That's all he was thinking of. Let me meet somebody. And then that bit of fear that was in the back of my mind started going. You got yourself ready. You knew what you got to do.
What kind of land did you land on?
I wasn't too bad. It was quite a soft thing. In fact, the field had actually been cut. It was like a cornfield, but it wasn't too bad a landing, to be quite honest. You know, I was quite surprised because, you know, with the gust of the wind, I suppose that wind must have been between 10, 15 miles an hour. Might have been more, might have been less, you see. But I'm no, I can't actually, you know, quote wind speed or anything like that. But it wasn't too bad a landing at all. I was thankful for that, really, because, you know, if you come down, you get a broken leg or an ankle, you're stuck. If you meet anybody, you can only tell them and hope that they'll send somebody down to help you. But other than that, well, that's your hard luck. It's as simple as that. I know it sounds callous. It really does. But Well, I'm sorry, mate. I'll let somebody know, and that's it. You're not concerned about it. We can't afford to be. Not that sort of stuff. Once the invasion's in full swing, and you know, you meet up with the Second Army, that's a different matter, you know, because you know you've got people backing you. You see, but when you're on your own, bye bye, forget about them.
So you weren't shot at as you were coming down.
Well, there was quite a bit of small arms fire, but I couldn't say whether they were firing anything out because they wasn't. But no, you could see the traces, you know, crisscrossing. But I wouldn't actually say they'd actually spotted anybody. To be quite honest with you, I think the Germans, more or less the same as us, were just scared something was happening. So what did they do? They just fired anywhere, hoping they was going to hit somebody. It's as simple as that.
So the fire didn't come near you.
Pardon?
The firing didn't come near you.
Oh, once you're on the ground, that was it, because we was only, what, about 400 or 500 yards from Pegasus Bridge when we dropped. It wasn't all that far away. So, the firing began, once they realised what was happening, because then it came through thick and fast, you see, and then within an hour, we were being mortared very heavily. Very heavily, but...
Did you dig trenches then?
Oh, God, yes, you dug. You dug, make no mistake about it. If you've never dug before in your life, you knew how to dig then. The only trouble was with the trenching tools they give us was hopeless, really. You know, for the job you had to do. But
why were they so bad?
Well, they were only small little things, but when you come across hard ground, it's a different matter if you've got a shovel where you can put your foot in. But these things, no, you had to whack it. There's no other way. You couldn't put your foot on and press them down, no way, you see. But you dug, as I say again, fear made you dig. The thought of, you've got to get down, get your bum in. That's the main thing, get your bum and your head in. Never mind anything else, you see.
Was the ground very hard?
No, not the first part. Well, it had already been sown, with corn, cut with corn, but it wasn't too bad at all. Other parts, some parts, yes, you did. You come across the old stones and the grit and so forth. But that was just, just bad luck, really, in that respect.
So you landed, you made contact with this officer.
With a couple of privates, first of all. Then we found Mr. Thomas. And then from then on, we just went where he went.
Where did you go?
We went to the bridge. That was the first contact we made. And then from there, we were sent down to Leeport.
Did you find at the bridge?
Oh, that was already taken. Major Howard, as I know him now, him and the rest of the ox and bucks that he took with him, they were already there. It was just the question that so many of the 7th Battalion was left there as reinforcements, really, to make sure that Jerry didn't put a push through and take the bridge back, you see. Even so, I gather that there was an ME-109, I believe it was, or 110, got through and bombed the bridge, and the bomb actually hit the bridge, so I was told, but it didn't go off. It bounced off and went into the canal itself. So, luck was on our side in that respect, you see.
So you left some comrades behind at the bridge, and then you went...
Then we went down. Each company had its own job after that, which he was prepared, he was told beforehand anyway. And then we made our way into Leeport. We got in there, got into the buildings. Unfortunately, you have to knock holes in them buildings. Rat holes, we called them, to use, for weapons through, smash the windows, because you couldn't afford to be... couldn't afford to be sorry for people. You're going over there to do a job. You're going to rescue these people. You're going to, take them away from the life they've been leading for the last 4 years. So a price has to be paid... Not only in lives, but in damage as well, unfortunately. Simple as that.
So you were taking up positions in these houses. How long was it before you were attacked in Leeport?
Well, virtually right from the time you got there.
By infantry or armour or what?
Oh, no, it was infantry by German snipers for more than anything, German infantry. One or two tanks come up, but they were sent packing, we with a few mortars and piats they had, available. But the 6-pounder guns they managed to get into operation eventually, saw most of those off. But we were fortunate, really, where the tanks were concerned. It was only I don't think they were tanks. I think they were more or less the old SPs, really. The the ATH placed on a tank chassis, because although we found out a lot later that Hitler had stuck mainly the, I think it was in the Pas-de-Calais area, Hitler had had a two or three tank divisions there, but for some unknown reason he kept them there because he firmly believed, I think, that's where the invasion was going to come, because Dover to Calais was the shortest route. So him being very nice to us by ordering this saved the day for us, because let's make no mistake about it, if he'd have released those tanks, I really, in all honesty, I don't think D-Day would have been successful. I really don't.
How long were you defending those positions in Le Pas?
Oh, God. Best part of a week. Maybe a week to 10 days sort of stuff.
What was it like in that fighting?
Well, no more than any other place, really. It was, you know, it's... how can I put it? Rough and ready. There are no comfort, if that's what you mean. Nothing comfortable about it at all. I mean, as regards to going to toilet, it was just a risk every time you went. As simple as that, you see. If you could make a cup of chow or anything like that, that was a risk, because you had to wait till daylight anyway, because night time, one light night time, and you had the snipers on you. So smoking was out as well, you see, but... it was a question of eating cold compo. Nothing could be cooked. When they did get it through, it was more or less cold anyway, because bearing in mind the cooks had a hell of a job. They had a job cooking it whilst they were under fire. They were being malted. Nobody got away with it. But then by the time it got through to you, I suppose them poor devils that brought it down, they had to do some dodging and ducking and diving. So more often than not, it was, you know, sort of cool, cold. You didn't think of that. It was grub. And you ate it.
What was in the compo rations?
Well, it was mainly like bully beef, McConaughey, that, like diced carrots, diced spuds, peas and so forth out of the tins. The hardtack biscuits, which I can assure you could sole your shoes with and you'd never wear them out. Whoever made those biscuits made a fortune. You'd never wear the roads out if they could put them on these roads, I can assure you. And the only way you could eat those, you soaked them, because there was no other way you could eat them. Teeth couldn't get through them. But yeah. that was all part and parcel of it, you see.
Could you see the targets that you were aiming at?
Oh, yes. Not always, but, I mean, more often than not, they popped up. You had a jerry came into your sights, and it was... The first shot I ever took... I have to admit it, I don't know if Phil did or anybody else will, but will I or won't I fire that gun? Because you're taking a man's life, remember. But then the thing that was drummed into you all through your training, it's him or you. And you're the only one that can make that decision. Who's it going to be? Well, as far as I was concerned, this kid was coming back to Blighty to my mum and dad and my family. So it's got to be him. People say to me, how many did he kill? I couldn't even tell you that. I didn't bother to count. I was only thankful that I was still alive. And this is all war is, really. It's the question of you're alive, regardless of what happens.
So you were using your 303 all the time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, the main thing with a 303, you've got to use it, but at the same time, you've got to make sure it's clean. You can't use a dirty rifle, because you can damage your own self with that. You get that front gets clogged up with mud and so forth. I mean, don't forget, if you get a mortar bomb coming through the air, or a shell's coming through the air, you can hear it. So what do? You duck. You've got to be careful that rifle don't go into the ground, because if you block that hole up and you pull that trigger, you will...